why don't we get started? There may be a few more people coming in, but we don't have a lot of time, as is always the case. Thank you so much for coming. I decided to turn the lights down just a little bit. This is a discussion about what you can see when it's dark, after all, so I thought that was appropriate. My name is James Plum, and I work at the University of Minnesota. I work essentially representing NASA in the state of Minnesota, doing NASA promotion or interest in space, outer space, things like that. And so I work for the Minnesota Space Grant Consortium. And in some sense, I'm kind of self-taught in aerospace and such topics, but it's always been an interest to me. So don't call me, the village astronomer if you must, but don't call me an astronomer, call me an amateur astronomer, please, because this is not what I do as far as serious research. Okay, the title that I've given to this particular presentation is a very standard question, especially when somebody comes out and takes a look for a telescope. It's like, wait a minute, that's not at all what it was supposed to look like, right? So why doesn't it look that way? That way being like that. Why doesn't it look like that? You can't walk outside and see that. Ever. And it's not because something's wrong with you, or maybe it is because something's wrong with you, but you can't. And it's not because if you had only a bigger telescope, you'd be able to. It's never happened. Okay? So part of the question for this session is, yep.
Can I adjust this window
sheet? Please.
I'll do it for you.
Okay.
Just keep it.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
There are issues going on, not the least of which is when you walk outside and look up, you are trying to make an astronomical observation with your eyes, naturally, okay? And, or you may be looking for a telescope, but you're still using your eyes, and you're doing so from the surface of the Earth. And these kind of go without even mentioning. But these things actually limit significantly what you're able to see. And so, clearly, we can get an image of this sort, and I can show it to you, but you'll never see this ever. Okay? And I see Scott in the back row, and he looks very disappointed, because, I told him, okay, you don't come out and look at telescopes, it's never going
to
look like this. But let's...
I promised it would.
I did not promise, well, maybe I did promise. That was the only way I could get it. Okay, so, let's talk about why it doesn't look like this, and how you succeed in doing this, and whether or not, if you can't do this with your naked eye, should you even bother, I guess. Okay, so these are some of the questions I'd like to talk about. So, let's say there's something wrong, in some sense. If that image was right, then I go out and I can't see that image, then there's something wrong. So, I'm interested in going out and seeing. That was the Andromeda Galaxy. So I'm going to just walk out right now. I'm going to go, and I go and look, and I don't see it. What do I see? I see the sky's blue. I don't see any stars at all, much less galaxies. So what's wrong? It's a little bit subtle what's wrong. It's not exactly that it's daytime that's related to it. The problem really is, yeah?
The atmosphere.
Basically, the problem is that there's light shining on our atmosphere. You're welcome if you live in the moon. You walk out in the daytime and look and you'll see the stars. No problem. Because the moon does not have an atmosphere. The problem is that the sun shines on our atmosphere, and then the atmosphere scatters the light, and so the entire atmosphere sort of glows in some sense. So the atmosphere looks blue from our perspective, and our atmosphere, in fact, is transparent. But if there's a big light shining on it and making it scatter light all over the place, you can't see through it. It becomes opaque. Okay? So, I mean, there's a fairly quick fix to this one. Don't go out right now. When should I go out instead? Yeah, well, I have to go. Okay, so I need to go out in the nighttime. So let's say I go out in the nighttime. Well, it's cloudy. Okay. So, I mean, things can go wrong, right? Still, no stars visible. So now what's the fix to that?
Move out of Seattle.
Okay, fair enough. Move out of the area. Well, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be cloudy tonight necessarily, but weather is a temporary phenomenon, and even when the sky is transparent, you can have problems with this. Okay? So, I went out at night, and I found at night that it was not cloudy, and I'm looking for the Andromeda Galaxy, and it's not in view.
Wrong time of the night or year.
It's not just the wrong time of the night, perhaps. It may well be the wrong time of the year. I have to be patient. I have to wait and let the Earth rotate and get this object in the sky, and that wait could be months. Because, frankly, if here's the sun, what's the sun? And here's the Earth. Anything in that direction is going to have this scattered light problem. I can only look at things over here. And if Andromeda's over there, I have to wait 6 months until the Earth is over here before I can really have access to it. Okay? So, you have to be patient, and sometimes being patient is not just waiting for the Earth to spin a little bit. It may well be patient for the Earth to go around well in its orbit before that object is available to you in the nighttime. Okay, but hey, I can wait. I'm patient. Okay, so now this target. It's up there. Maybe I can see it, maybe, but it's kind of small. What's the solution to that?
Magnification.
Oh, okay, so now I need some sort of an optical device to help me make it look bigger. And that's where telescopes start to become useful. Telescopes sometimes magnify, not always, but sometimes they'll magnify things. Okay? But even if I manage to magnify it, I might still not be able to get a good look at it. This is a big problem. The object is too faint. Now what's the fix to that? Okay, so I'm trying to stay away from these long time exposure things. I'm still looking with my eyes. But the main purpose of telescopes is not to magnify. The main purpose of telescopes is to have a big collecting area and funnel all of that information into your eye, allowing you to see things that are too faint to see normally. Okay? So telescopes will help me solve this problem. But here's a whole list of problems, shall we say. Okay? Now here's a real problem. What if this object, this is not true of Andromeda, but it could be true of certain sources, the object is not giving off light in the visible spectrum. It's an X-ray source, or it's a radio source, or it's an infrared source. I have no solution to that one. If I'm doing visible astronomy with my eyes, I can't get around this one. There are limitations to what your eyes can see. Okay, so this is just, can't get around it, but photographs of that sort maybe can get around it by using cameras and stuff, which can get access to this kind of information. Of course, to show us this kind of information has to be put into the visible, and so then people have to fake it, right? It's like, well, okay, so it was infrared, so I'm going to color it red. Or it was ultraviolet, so I'm going to color it violet, or something like that. It's not really violet, but I'm going to color it violet just to kind of remind you where it came from. X-rays, who knows what color they should be, but they have to be some color, otherwise we wouldn't be able to perceive them on the page or on the screen. Okay? Here's a big problem. The light from the target doesn't reach the ground. The atmosphere is actually opaque to certain kinds of light. The atmosphere is not opaque to visible light, and this is related to the fact that we can see invisible light because that's the light available to us. The atmosphere also allows radio light through. Okay? Turns out we didn't turn out to be radio detectors, but we have radios, I guess. But the atmosphere tends to be opaque to many other kinds of light, and if the light isn't reaching the ground, then we're pretty much stuck as well. With equipment and getting outside of the atmosphere, we can maybe fix this one, but for the moment, we're going to be kind of stuck. Now, let's say we can actually see it, but now it's twinkling, it's fuzzy. What's that all about? That's the atmosphere too, okay? Essentially, the atmosphere is not so steady. The atmosphere is turbulent some days and less so other days. Turns out if you look straight up, you're not looking through as much atmosphere, and you usually will get a better view. If you're looking way out close to the horizon, you're looking through extra layers of atmosphere, because you're looking through the atmosphere, which is the aphic, except you're looking through it sideways. Things will always twinkle even more on the horizon. Well, hey, move south or something like that. South as in way past the equator or something like that, okay? To get the object overhead or look for it when it's overhead. This is one way to fight against this. Also, climb a high mountain. If you climb a high mountain, you might be able to get above some of the turbulence in the atmosphere at least and improve your seeing. People talk about poor seeing or good seeing. So here's a whole list of problems and some ideas of how we might try and fix them. So here's my alternative title to this talk, I guess. Limitations of naked eye observing, and it sort of goes without saying that we're doing so from the surface of the Earth and that we're doing so with our eyes, possibly using a telescope, but not using cameras necessarily. We're looking through a telescope or looking completely unaided naked eye. So let's think about some of the limitations of the structure of and the abilities of the human eye, and then also some limitations associated with the atmosphere. We've mentioned some of these already. I just want to run through them one more time. Okay, so light has to get into your eye, and it comes in through the pupil, and the pupil's not very big. Okay? So it would be handy if we could collect more light and funnel it down and get it through that hole. Okay? So there's a limitation of the human eye. Here's a very important limitation of the human eye, and that is the human eye has this problem that every 30 times a second or so, it takes any information that's collected and it dumps it into the brain. It's like a time exposure on a camera, and it's fixed. Can't change it. It's about a 1/30th of a second. So pretty much, if there's not enough light to trigger your eye in 1/30th of a second, you'll never see it, ever. You can't let the light accumulate. Your eye does not do that. Cameras can do that, but your eye will not let you do that. Okay, so the exposure time of your eye is fixed at about 1/30th of a second. Your sensitivity of your eye is limited. especially if you're looking at faint objects, you're really lousy, have very lousy color vision when you're looking at faint objects. Some of us, me, has really lousy color vision all the time, okay, that's just me. But even good people with very good color vision, when the light levels are low, they can't see colors very well. And so you'll see colors in astronomical images, which have been put there carefully by the people taking the pictures through filters and stuff. Nothing will ever look that colorful when you look at it directly. It just doesn't, mostly because of your eyes, not up to it. Okay? And then, of course, our eyes are only good for visible light, even though objects, astronomical objects, tend to give off light in many different ranges. I have an interesting demonstration here. Let's see if this works. Okay? I have with me two flashlights. This one, I assume you can see that one, yes? Mm-hmm. It's a visible light flashlight. And then here I have an infrared flashlight. Can you see this one?
No.
I'm turning it on and off. You can't see it. Well, fully on you. Okay? It turns out that lots of things will give off infrared light, and cameras in general can pick up infrared light just as they can pick up visible light. Let me see if I can convince you of that by just turning on the camera of my computer here. So, here we go. There I am. Oh, man. Don't look at me. Look at my visible light flashlight. Here we go. Oh, I can see that one easily. Okay? Here's my infrared flashlight. It's like this one. Isn't that neat? Aha, uh-huh. Okay, so now all I need is my computer to look instead of me, or something like that. Cameras in general can pick up infrared light. Our eyes won't, and if our eyes don't, then we're kind of stuck, especially if we're thinking about looking at objects that are giving off infrared light in this particular case. Okay, on we go. So, now let's talk about limitations associated with viewing through the atmosphere, especially as they pertain mostly to visible light. Okay, so clouds can restrict view, as can mountains. This is a big problem here. The view from here, astronomically, is poor. And the reason is there's these big mountains on both sides of us. So at this time of the year, for instance, the ecliptic, which is where the planet in the solar system, so all the planets, if there are any planets in our night sky, are on the ecliptic, and the ecliptic is below the mountains all the time. What can I do? I can't show you Saturn. It's out there, but it's behind the mountains. Okay? So this is a problem that's associated with cold and our location on the surface of the Earth. And then we talked about this scattering of sunlight making the atmosphere generally opaque in the daytime. Turns out the atmosphere is not opaque to radio, which is good. Okay, so you can do radio astronomy in the daytime, but not visible light astronomy in the daytime. Light pollution. Light pollution isn't necessarily due only to polluting sources. There's a lot of light pollution going on right now here at Holden because the moon's full. What can I do? Okay, the moon is full, and the moon actually causes the entire sky sort of to glow just a little bit. Even when you can't see the moon shines off of the nearby mountains. And so the other night we were out with telescopes, and it turned out it wasn't dark enough even to see the Milky Way. The reason is mostly because the moon was full. Also, some light from the village. So, light pollution from people or natural sources. You can avoid that. You just have to go away from people and time it so that you don't have natural sources giving you lots of light. And then, of course, there's atmospheric turbulence. We've already mentioned that. Yes. And I already mentioned this also, the fact that the atmosphere is opaque to most kinds of light. I'm using light to refer to electromagnetic radiation. Visible light is a fraction of light, but there's also X-rays, there's also microwaves, there's also infrared, there's also ultraviolet. These are all kinds of light in my book, at least. And the atmosphere, in fact, you can't see through it in many kinds of light. Here's a graph that shows what kinds of light can get through the atmosphere. So up here I have 100% opaque or 0% opaque, that means transparent. And what I see is, for the different kinds of light, here's the visible spectrum. It's only a small part of the entire spectrum. Visible spectrum gets through pretty well. Radio gets through fairly well, at least certain kinds of radio. Really long radio waves don't get through at all. They're completely blocked, okay? Infrared is almost all completely blocked. And X-rays and gamma rays are almost all completely blocked. That's actually probably a good thing because those are bad biologically. Okay? So if you get outside of the atmosphere, then you suddenly get irradiated with all this bad stuff. And so the fact that the atmosphere protects us is good, I guess, but it's not so helpful if you're trying to look at an X-ray source astronomically. So you need to do that. You pretty much have to go outside the atmosphere with a spacecraft.
So, James, excuse
yep.
me. You know, visible light spectrum, you've got either side of 1 on your graph. And up to 10, there's quite a few dips on the infrared side.
Sure.
Are all of those up to 10 considered infrared, or is there different?
You have your near infrared and your far infrared. Near just being close to what you can really see, and far. I don't have memorized how far infrared goes, but it turns out that yes, indeed, most of this stuff would be considered infrared, and so some kinds of infrared will get through. And a given source will often give off light in many different ranges, maybe even continuously, and so you can see it, but only in certain colors. Essentially, only certain colors will come through. So you might get the idea that, oh yeah, that's a very bright infrared source, when it turns out it's really a very bright ultraviolet source. You just couldn't see the ultraviolet at all from the surface of the Earth. And so you can fool that way. So if you're going to build telescopes on the surface of the Earth, they're going to have to be radio telescopes or visible light, pretty much. I'll show you one picture later on of an airplane that flies very high in the atmosphere and carries an infrared telescope, but that's kind of unusual. And if we're doing it with naked eye, well, then it's only going to be visible, because that's the only thing we can see anyway. Okay, so quickly, a few more lists here, and then we're going to get on to some funner stuff, like pictures and diagrams and good stuff like that. So, some solutions. Telescopes allow you to gather more light, focus it down, and get it into your eye and form an image. Telescopes allow you to make that image bigger than what you would perceive the actual object to be, so they can magnify, depending on how you set up the optics. And this is for telescopes and looking through the telescope. I'm not necessarily talking about taking pictures. Often if you take pictures, you don't bother with the eyepiece. You just put the camera where the image is being formed, and then you don't even use the word magnification anymore. You talk about resolution. Okay? Telescopes, the Earth is rotating, and so you can put a mount on the telescope to counter-rotate so as to adjust for that, and therefore keep things in view for a long time. The telescopes I had out the other night did not have this feature, so we had to keep adjusting them because of the rotation of the Earth, things drifted out of our field of view. And it's possible for certain kinds of telescopes, especially radio telescopes, if you're careful about it, you can actually link the telescopes together and pretend that you have a really huge telescope, even though it's only one telescope here and one telescope here, and you feed in the information and combine it. You can do that with radio, you can't really do that with visible. That's called interferometry. If you put cameras now on top of the telescopes, you can store the images. It used to be with film. Film is a little bit like the human eye. Only about 1% of the light that gets in actually causes anything to happen. So film is very inefficient. Charge couple devices, CCDs, and the like, and digital cameras are much better, 70% efficient sometimes. And so that's one way to make things get brighter right away, is just to use something that isn't throwing away 99% of the light that comes to it. And you can take time exposures. Okay, so the idea is you can let it accumulate light over a long time, and you can track the stars, typically. And so, but there's limits to that, too, remember, because it's going to get daytime eventually. So you can probably only do time exposures, at least from the surface, that last as long as there is nighttime, which is some number of hours, but not 24. One thing that you can do with cameras is you can intentionally block out all the light except for green, or all the light except for red, or something like that, and then you can do a longer time exposure with red and a shorter time exposure with green, and then mix the colors back together again and get interesting features to come out if you want to. So you can use filters and then mix things back together and come up with better images, perhaps. And then you can, of course, have cameras that will sense things other than visible light, like I just demonstrated. Here's something that's actually very important. You can break the light that's coming in into its respective colors and look very carefully at what colors are coming at you. Depending on the colors you see, you can learn a lot about the source. For example, different atoms give off colors that are very, almost like fingerprints, okay? And so when people were starting to figure this out, they said, oh, that's the light that comes from neon, and that's the light that comes from hydrogen, and that's the light, I don't know where that light comes from. In the solar spectrum are some very strong lines, presumably from something in the sun. And no one had ever found this thing on the Earth. So they just call it something. Helium. Helios. Named after the sun. And later we discovered helium on the Earth. Okay? Helium on the Earth is hard to find because it occurs deep underground for the most part. But anyway, so it was by spectroscopy that people discovered that the sun was made of this thing, which just didn't seem to be common at all on the Earth. And they figured this out a long time before they found it on the Earth. So you can also learn about whether things are moving. If you see the fingerprint for hydrogen, but the fingerprint is shifted over toward the red, that means the object that was giving off the light is moving away from you, and if it's shifted toward the blue, it's moving towards you. And so In actuality, the way we can tell that the universe is expanding is because everything we look at almost is shifted towards the red. No matter which way we look, everything seems to be moving away from us. So that's another thing you can get from spectroscopy. Okay, let's talk about telescopes. The first person to do very much with telescopes is Galileo. He wasn't the first person to actually use a telescope or build one, but he improved upon the telescopes that were available in his day. And he was probably the first person to do very much significantly with telescopes looking at the sky. So I like this picture because it shows him with his telescope in hand and his friendly, happy face. This was the early 1600s. And what happened was Galileo started looking at things in the sky, and he noticed that there were imperfections on the surface of the moon. It was not a perfect object. That got him in big trouble. He noticed that there were things that went around Jupiter. It didn't go around the Earth, clearly. That got him in really big trouble. And then he noticed that Venus went through phases, which meant it couldn't possibly be circling the Earth. It had to be circling the Sun. And they put him in the slammer for that one. Pretty much, everything he looked at in the sky got him in trouble. Okay, so take that any way you want to. Here's a telescope not too different from the one that was available to Galileo. It turns out that he built telescopes for the Navy so that they could look at ships far out at sea. And so he had telescopes that didn't invert things. His design was a non-inverting telescope, an easier design to build. This one, actually, shows things that are upside down. It doesn't really matter, usually, when you're looking at astronomy objects. So that would be called a Kepler version. So, I'm sorry, I'm going backwards here. So I'm not going to spend much time on this, but essentially the idea is that light comes into the telescope. This is a Galilean telescope. It comes through a lens, okay? And the lens will focus it down, and then when it comes to the focus, here's a lens that actually takes it, spreads it back out, and puts it into your eye. So in other words, all the light that was coming that's big, shall we say, gets brought down into small and dumped into your eye. And so that means that what you form as far as an image can be larger than, magnified, larger than the object that you're looking at. If I look at the Kepler version, I'll notice that the object and the image there, one of them is upside down with respect to the other, but it's similar. In the case of the Kepler version, what you do is you take your original lens, you bring the light down, then it goes past the focus point, comes back to a second lens, and then the second lens straightens it out and puts it into your eye. There are problems building these refracting telescopes with lenses. One of the problems is that you have to make a very good piece of glass and grind it just right, and then you have to support it on the edges. And the reason is because the light has to travel through the object. And so there's a limit. This is about as big as you could possibly make. Well, you could make, but this is the biggest one that was ever put into effective use, a 40-inch diameter telescope that has lenses in it. It turns out that you can go much, much, much bigger than this if you only use mirrors instead of lenses. And the reason is mirrors, you can support them from behind. You don't have light doesn't have to travel through them. It's easier to make mirrors in general. So pretty much after this particular telescope was built, 1890 something, I forget, they kind of stopped making bigger and bigger refracting telescopes. This was the biggest one. Newton, in fact, was the promoter, one of the earliest promoters, of making telescopes that use mirrors instead of lenses. So the idea is you use a curved mirror, and the curved mirror will bounce the light back to a focus. So here's actually a reproduction of one of Newton's telescopes.
Can I move? It's over.
Oh, please. Okay. Sorry, I shouldn't have left that so much out in the way. Okay, so this is how Newton's telescope works. Essentially, the light comes into the telescope, it strikes a mirror, and then the mirror brings it back to a focus, and the focus is right there. The problem is, if you stick your head in and try to see what the telescope is seeing, you block the light that's coming into the mirror, because your head is in the way. That wasn't a problem with refractors, because the light travels through the lenses, and your eye and your head is on the far side. Okay? So the way to solve this is Newton's solution at least, was to take the light, and before it got all the way back to the focus, to put a mirror here, and then the mirror sends the light out of the telescope body, and then you look at it out there instead. So that mirror will block some of the light, that's true, but not as much as your head perhaps would. And so this is a simple ray diagram for the Newton version of the telescope. Another possibility would be to make a hole in the main mirror here, and so that your mirror that is going to get the light out of the body actually sends it back right through the middle of the main mirror and sends it up here. This is called the Cassegrain solution. This is quite common. The Newtonian solution is quite common. And you can build really big telescopes with mirrors of this sort. And then depending on what you're trying to do, you would either put an eyepiece out here so you could see it with your eyes, or you put a camera out here, something like that. As far as where to put a telescope, it's location, 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 right? That's what they say always about real estate. Well, telescopes is the same way. So you're looking for someplace, probably someplace quite high, in hopes of getting above some of the atmospheric turbulence. Someplace that's very dry, and the reason for that is that some of the light that fails to get through the atmosphere fails because it is interacting with humidity, essentially. And so if you can get it to be high and dry, you're good. So away above mountains in the deserts, these are good places. Some place that has really good clear weather regularly, and remote. Remote as in far away from sources of light, from people, and then you just have to avoid, you know, full moon and things like that. Of course, you need to go into outer space if you're trying to study light that doesn't get through the atmosphere in the first place. Okay, so that's just not an option. And then, oh, this is kind of cool. It's possible, actually, to compensate to some degree for the turbulence of the atmosphere using what's called adaptive optics. And so I'm going to show you a little video clip of that. But before I do, let me just point out, here's an example of a mountaintop. This is Kitt Peak near Tucson, Arizona. And clearly a popular place for astronomers. All sorts of telescopes are built way up there. And there are similar mountaintops in Hawaii and Mauna Kea and Chile and lots of different places. So here's a minute and a half or so of a video from the Gemini telescope talking about how you can adjust the optics of the telescope in real time so as to correct for some of the turbulence in the atmosphere. Okay? So this is actually, I think this is very cool. Here we go. So I'll just talk you through this. This is what the telescope looks like, and essentially here comes the light. The light's coming in, it's bouncing off this main mirror, it's bouncing off that secondary mirror, it's going to go through this hole in the telescope. So this is a standard Cassegrain design. Now that the light is kind of behind the scenes in the telescope, it's going to be ferried into a variety of different instruments, and this is the adaptive optics instrument. So what happens is the light that comes in is distorted because of the turbulence of the atmosphere. And so we're going to be looking at the light ultimately on a computer screen. So here comes the light. It's going to bounce off of this mirror. It's going to go through some various optics. And ultimately, the light is going to go, the red part, is going to go to a detector, and that detector is going to draw a picture on the screen. And as we're going to see in a moment, that picture on the screen is pretty fuzzy, not great seeing. So here's what happens in the case of adaptive optics. You send some of the light, instead of sending that light straight to the screen, yes, we're still running. Okay, here comes the light, and the light is drawn as planes that are kind of distorted because of the turbulence of the atmosphere. What you do then is you take this information about this distorted light, and you send it up, and you control the surface of this final mirror, and you distort the mirror so as to make the light undistorted. And now that the light is undistorted, it's going to come, and it's going to go to the screen, and watch what happens, and this is actually a very realistic view of what happens when you turn on your system. It's not perfect, but it's much better. Question?
There's a slight delay, right, between the...
Sure, fair enough. There is a slight delay, and so the question is whether or not you can keep up with the turbulence of the atmosphere. It turns out you can. It turns out that as long as you know what the turbulence is over the course of some few seconds and can adjust for it, it's pretty good. In fact, sometimes people will do it a little bit differently than that. They'll shine a laser beam up into the sky, and they'll look at their own laser beam to try and understand what the turbulence is, and then they'll adjust their mirrors based on what they're seeing in their laser beam and then apply it to their star images. Okay? Yes?
How do you make a mirror change shape?
Fair enough. So mirrors, the nice thing about mirrors is they're very thin, and so in this particular case, instead of making the mirror on a solid piece of glass, you make the mirror on a piece of flexible material, and you put motors behind it, literally. And you push the motors around, and you change the shape. And you can do it in real time. You just need some computing power to decide what shape you want. And you can't change the shape a lot. But frankly, you don't need to change the shape a lot. You only need to change the shape enough to flatten out these planes of light. And the planes of light with their wavelengths essentially are only going to be a few, you know, angstroms long.
Right.
Okay. So that's one possible solution if you're trying to do ground observing, but of course it's not for naked eye. Okay, now it's time to just take a look at, how are we doing time-wise? Let's look at just some photographs of some current, typically fairly large telescopes. Here, for instance, are the Keck telescopes. There's two of them. These are built on a mountaintop in Hawaii, in Mauna Kea. And each of them is approximately 10 meters across. This is not a person. This is actually a reflection of a person. But that's the right size for a person if a person had been standing right next to that mirror. So what you see is this mirror is not a continuous curve, but rather this mirror is made of these hexagon shapes, and each hexagon shape is a little bit over 1 meter in diameter. Put them together, you get approximately a 10-meter diameter collecting surface, and then there's two of them, okay? So that's one of the big optical telescopes that's available, but it is certainly on the ground. It does not have adaptive optics in this one, okay? Radio telescopes, here's a 1,000-foot dish. This is too big to steer. So essentially, this just fits in a bowl in the Earth in Puerto Rico, and then you point based on where the sun is, where the Earth is pointing you as you go around. So basically, things will come in and out of your view. You can steer it just a little bit by taking the reflected radio light comes up here to these receivers, and if you move the receivers around just a little bit, you can get a little bit of pointing ability. Typically, this is about a 300-meter dish. It's a fixed dish. There are a few 100-meter dishes that are actually steerable, but you can't steer something this big. On the other hand, what you can do instead, if you want to, is here are 27 25-meter dishes. These are in New Mexico, and they're on railroad cars. And you can actually spread these out over more than 30 kilometers. So what's going on in this particular situation is it's almost like you have a telescope that's 30 kilometers across. You don't have full receiving capability on the entire 30 kilometers, but if you tie the telescopes together, this is interferometer now, okay, you can pretend that you have a 30-kilometer diameter telescope. Now, this is actually important, and the reason is the resolution that you can achieve with the telescope depends on two things. It depends on the wavelength of the light you're looking at, and it depends on the diameter of the telescope from the farthest end to the other farthest end of who knows what's going on. And usually it's a continuous reflector in between, but not always, okay? So the problem with radio telescopes is radio light is very long. The waves are very long. The wavelength is very long. So you need a really huge size of reflector to get any resolution at all. And this is one way to achieve it. This is the way to achieve it in one site. Another way to achieve it, actually, is to link up telescopes across the Earth, and then you can get not the very large array, but what is it called, the ultra-large array or something like that, where you essentially have telescopes on either side of the continental United States and out in the Pacific and et cetera. Then you can make a telescope that's essentially the size of the Earth, and then you can get tremendously good resolution, even in the radio. It's not going to be as bright because you only have a small amount of collecting area, relatively speaking, but the apparent diameter of the telescope can be very large.
But they have to be pointing at ones on the sides.
Yes, of course. You have to point them properly, and so they won't all be pointing straight up. Especially if they're on different sides of the Earth, they'll be pointing toward the horizon. They could both be pointing toward the northern horizon, for instance, and one would be over here, and one would be over here. You just have to be careful. And the key is that you have to tie the images together and figure out if it came to you and it came to me and it was delayed by a microsecond. What does that mean? Okay. Here's Sophia. So Sophia is flown in a 747, heavily modified, and it does infrared imaging by getting above most of the humidity in the atmosphere. Okay, so that's a very nice telescope, but again, not something that you would normally encounter and look through with the naked eye. All these telescopes take pictures and people look at the pictures. The people who run the telescopes often are not at the telescopes at all. They just send in a request, and they say, oh yeah, you can have some time on Keck, and then they point it where you tell them to point it, and they send you your files, and you look at them. That's how astronomy is mostly done, is there. Of course, now it's time to go to outer space. So here's Chandra. Chandra is an X-ray telescope. The trick with X-rays is that they're so energetic that if you put a surface, even a supposedly reflective surface, let me start over again. If you want to reflect something, you need to have a surface that's essentially smooth, at least on the scale of the waves you're interested in reflecting. So for instance, for microwaves. Microwaves are, a centimeter long. So the door of your microwave probably has holes in it, and you can even see inside. And the reason is, the reflective surface doesn't have to be solid. As long as it doesn't have holes bigger than about a centimeter, microwaves will reflect off it pretty well. So it's like a mirror to the microwave, but you can still see in with visible light, because visible light is really tiny. Okay. The problem with X-rays is X-rays are so short that even individual atoms lined up next to each other are too bumpy to form a good surface to reflect X-rays. okay? And so it's very difficult to make an X-ray mirror. And you want a mirror so as to get a telescope. So the way this thing works, actually, is that it has a whole bunch of concentric, very long tubes, essentially, and the X-rays come in and they graze off of this long tube. And so the idea is if you can line up a whole bunch of atoms and look at them from a very oblique angle, it'll look like a more or less a good surface, and then you can get the thing. So this thing doesn't look at all like a regular telescope because it doesn't have this standard mirror that's kind of perpendicular to the incoming light, the X-ray light in this very good place. So here's an artist's conception of what it looks like. This has been in orbit and continues to do good work. I'm going to show you some pictures later on of stuff that's come from some of these big telescopes. Here's Hubble, probably the most famous of the space telescopes. Hubble has a 2.4 meter mirror, so that means the mirror for Hubble, 2.4 meters. Let's see, here's 1 meter. Okay, it would fit inside this room, frankly. Hubble is not a tremendously large telescope as far as the size of the mirror, but just for scale, here are a couple astronauts working on Hubble when it's attached to the space station. They're actually fixing it. I'll get to that in a moment. And so you can get an idea that a person standing up, you know, goes halfway across it. So if I back up one, essentially, this is the size of a person, and there's another person there. So this thing is, you know, about 3 stories high, approximately. Hubble does imaging in the visible and infrared and ultraviolet, all three, with different instruments. It turns out that when Hubble was first launched, some of you will remember, there was this big brouhaha about, oh, they screwed up. They didn't screw up much. It turns out that they were polishing this mirror, which is 2.4 meters in diameter, and they messed up by a distance that was less than 1/50th of the thickness of a human hair. That's enough. That's enough to do this. That's enough to take a photograph which was supposed to look like this and make it look like that. So essentially when Hubble was first launched, it was a pretty good telescope. It just wasn't better than the ones on the ground that it was supposed to be. Okay? So what they did is they gave it spectacles, more or less. And so they figured out, it took them several years to do so, them, I should say us, it took NASA several years to do so, how to put in some corrective optics, and after the corrective optics went in place, then they were actually able to start getting the kind of quality of images that they expected. But they had to dispense with some of the instruments so as to make way for the corrective optics. So this photograph actually, this is Hoffman, who happens to work for Space Grant in Massachusetts, so I know him, and Musgrave installing the corrective optics on the first servicing mission, and then Hubble has been serviced several times since to put it, bring its technology kind of up to date. But this was the most important of the fixes. They couldn't ever replace the main mirror. So the main mirror remains in place and it remains incorrect, but the corrective optics have been doing a good job. Okay, Kepler, I particularly like Kepler. Kepler's a much smaller telescope, but Kepler has been searching for extrasolar planets. So what it does is it sits and looks for its entire lifespan, which will be about 4 years long. It's getting close to the end of its lifespan, in fact. Okay, and it's looking at a field of view that's easily available in our sky right tonight. Okay, here's Cygnus the Swan, and there's Vega. So these are two bright stars in the sky tonight. And it's looking at this area of stars, and it never looks anywhere else. It just looks there continuously for 4 years. And what it's trying to do is it's trying to look for a very subtle dimming and brightening of stars, about 100,000 stars in its view, all of them in the nearby local Milky Way. And if it ever sees a star get a little bit dimmer and then brighter, and then later on a little bit dimmer and brighter, it says, aha, that's probably because there's an orbiting planet, which is covering a little bit of the brightness of that star. Okay? And so it turns out that Kepler has discovered dozens of stars that have planets. And frankly, it's unlikely that any star, even one with planets, would be so perfectly lined up that we'd see it from Earth. So the fact that they've seen dozens means that there are thousands of them, for sure, because they missed most of them. You know, they only see one fraction of a percent.
And, James, why did they pick that patch of sky to look at?
Well, essentially, you can see that if this is the Milky Way, so they're looking where there are lots of stars, for instance, but no great reason. I'm sure there are some not so great reason. But essentially, they were looking for a field in which they could see many stars, hopefully a bunch of stars not too far away. And they selected this so that they could observe continuously about 100,000 stars. Had they chosen a different direction, they might have been able to observe some more, maybe, or some fewer in certain directions. So this is sort of in the direction of the Milky Way, but not toward the center of the Milky Way. The center of the Milky Way is up here.
And so just to be clear, all these stars are in our Milky Way galaxy.
All the, yeah, basically, yes, they're all the stars that they are watching are in our Milky Way. You can see stars in that Andromeda photograph I started with. You can see individual stars. But those stars are much too far away to pull this off, because this is a dimming on the order of a tenth of a percent of brightness. Okay, and so need to be above the atmosphere for one thing, because atmospheric turbulence makes stars brighten and dim much more than that just on a regular basis if you look at them from the ground. Coming soon, the Webb Space Telescope. This is an infrared telescope. People sometimes talk about it as the replacement to Hubble. In fact, it's much better than Hubble in infrared and does not do other things, and so it's not really going to do exactly what Hubble did. This is going to be placed into orbit outside of the orbit of the Moon, not even close to the Earth. This is not going to be a serviceable object. And it should be launched within a few years. That's what they've been saying for a long time. I think 2015 is the current expected launch date for Webb, if I remember. Here shows a little bit about the size of the Hubble primary mirror compared to the James Webb primary mirror. It's a much bigger object. Okay, so let me just show you a few images from some of these telescopes or similar telescopes, and then we're going to get back to this question about going out and looking outside, and should we even bother doing that? Okay, so for instance, here's the Sun. These are some of the most recent pictures I could get off the internet from the Sun. These came from the SOHO satellite. And so the Sun has a few sunspots on it. The size of the Earth, if you were in front of the Sun with the Earth, would be the size of the black part of that, not even the full part of that, but just the black part of that. The Earth is pretty insignificant compared to the Sun. It turns out if I look at the Sun in ultraviolet, I see some interesting things. One thing is I see that there's something really going on here. And oh yes, I can just barely make it out in the visible, but I can't even tell that this thing is available in the visible at all. So there's features here that are just completely invisible. But no, they are in ultraviolet. And then you can take pictures of the Sun in X-ray as well. It turns out that the Sun does not give off X-rays. The Sun is too cold for that. But the corona of the Sun will give off X-rays when it's active. So here's a set of pictures that were taken over 4 years in the early 90s by a Japanese spacecraft, actually. And so these pictures were taken when the Sun was particularly active, and then as the Sun quieted down, the Sun has a cycle where it gets more active and less active. And so by the end of this time, the Sun was in its least active phase. Now the Sun is actually back to being quite active again. Most of what you're seeing in the X-rays, though, here is coming from the corona as opposed to from the surface of the Sun.
What's causing the Sun to become more and less active?
You know, that's not well understood, at least not by me. Essentially, the Sun is a dynamic system, and there's always seething and churning, but there's definitely very sort of, well, relatively long scale things going on. Mm-hmm. The Sun, you can tell this activity cycle by counting sunspots, for instance, and it's like a 22-year cycle where the magnetism of the Sun sort of diminishes and it comes back in the opposite direction and diminishes and comes back. So there's inner things going on in the Sun. I think the answer is it's not fully understood why. But some people certainly know much more about that than I do, so I'm not even going to try to explain other than that this is a well-documented, long-term cycling phenomenon associated with the Sun.
Are there effects on the Earth?
There are effects on the Earth. While the Sun is active, it does bad things, as far as we're concerned. One thing it will do is it will spit at us. Okay, it will not only send out its standard solar wind, but it will actually send out large amounts of material in various directions. We can get pictures of them, and sometimes they head right towards us. If they head right towards us, it can knock out satellites that are outside of our protective magnetic field. It can actually increase the temperature of our atmosphere, making it grow. And when it grows, then it captures satellites which were outside of the atmosphere and are not outside the atmosphere anymore and make them crash. It can cause power blackouts on the Earth on occasion, or related to sun activity. Usually we get a couple days' notice because we see these things starting in the visible, but it takes a while for the material to reach us. But yes, indeed, there are consequences to us, especially to the things that are outside of our atmosphere. Is our atmosphere and our magnetic field tend to protect us from most of this stuff. You get more northern lights and things like that when this is going on because all this stuff is getting channeled down and dumping in the places where our magnetic field strikes the Earth as well. I particularly like this pair of photographs. If I look on the left, this is the familiar constellation Orion with the red supergiant Betelgeuse up in the upper left-hand shoulder, Rigel, a bright, very bright young star down on the right-hand side. It turns out that in the direction of Orion, there's a lot of gas. This is called the Orion, what is this called? I didn't know it to myself. Oh, well. Okay, it's called the, well, this is called the Orion Nebula right here. And you can see this a little bit in the visible light. But it turns out if you look in the infrared, that's the wrong label, sorry. This is Orion in visible and infrared. And you'll see that there's a tremendous amount of stuff going on. One thing in the infrared is I can actually see Betelgeuse, but that's one of the very few stars I can see at all. However, certain things like the Orion Nebula here are clearly much broader than you would expect. And then there's other features that you just don't see at all in the visible. For instance, here is the remnant of an explosion that happened approximately here. And then this is the ring that's going around it. I don't see that at all. And so there's a tremendous amount of detail that's just completely missed if you limit yourself to visible observations. I need to fix that, sorry. Okay, this is a little bit cheating because this was not taken from a telescope on the Earth. This is taken from a telescope on a spacecraft. This is Saturn, as seen from the Cassini spacecraft, which has been orbiting Saturn for some years now. And taken in a very nice way. It was taken in the shadow of the planet. So the idea is they could open up their cameras and whatever more and take longer time exposures. And so this is looking back, and you can see certain features here that you wouldn't normally be able to see if you were observing Saturn from the sun side. One thing that I particularly like, which isn't related to Saturn at all, but I mentioned this in a previous talk as well, is I can actually see the Earth. That's the Earth right there. As viewed, because the Earth is in the direction of the sun. So that's about a billion miles away. So I think that's very neat. And then just a couple closing shots from Hubble itself. So here's a couple interacting galaxies. And maybe in some sense, at least at the present time, I think of this as almost the ultimate photograph from Hubble. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And so essentially, excepting for this single star here, I can tell it's a star because of the fact that I've got this cross on it, that's an optical effect. Everything in this picture is actually a galaxy. And this was taken from a tremendously long time exposure. Many orbits of Hubble were dedicated to collecting this image. And some of the objects in this image, especially the ones that look very small, are very far away. And since they're very far away, that means the light has taken a long time to get here. And so we're kind of looking at things that are not too old and things that are very, very, very old in the same photograph here. And so if I think about each of those dots is a galaxy, each galaxy has something like 100 billion stars in it. Okay, and if I look at this, I can see, about 1,000 or more galaxies in this one image. So you do the math. There's lots and lots of stars. And this particular thing was taken in a direction that was pretty much devoid of nearby stars, so that we could spend lots of time looking deeper than that. And so essentially, if this is at all typical, there's probably about 100 billion galaxies, as each of which has about 100 billion stars. Okay? So that's kind of the limit. But let's get back to the real question. Considering all that, should we even bother? Is it even worthwhile going outside looking up? Okay? I would like to say yes, for a variety of reasons. It turns out that there's some things you can actually see better in telescopes, and some things you can see better without telescopes than you can see with any of these big instruments. Many of the original discoveries, were made by people doing naked eye observing and observing with eyes through telescopes, small telescopes, and therefore, you can kind of, follow in the footsteps of Galileo if you want to. So I think that there are some good reasons to go outside anyway, and then, use this to complement your appreciation of these photographs. So let me just show you just list a few things that I consider good targets for unaided naked eye observing, not even using telescopes, okay? So for instance, constellations. Constellations in general are much too big to get into the field of view of a telescope. In fact, when you look in a telescope, you very often will see more stars than you can see naked eye, and so things get very confusing. And so it's better to look at constellations, if you want to help find your way around the sky, without using a telescope, okay? Satellites. So here's that heavensabove.com website that can tell you in advance, if you're interested, what is likely to pass over, when it rises, how high it gets. But or you can go there after the fact and see, what was that I saw last night? It was really very bright. You can't really watch satellites very effectively with a telescope, even. And the reason is because you have to slew so fast, and telescopes aren't designed to do that. Meteors, especially during meteor showers, shooting stars, can't pick those up well on telescopes at all. Okay. And so these are best seen naked eye. In fact, you do time exposures and sometimes get streaks across your photographs if you want to. The sun, of course, you have to be careful. You shouldn't look directly at the sun. But as long as you use appropriate precautions of looking at the sun or imaging the sun indirectly, you can, of course, watch the sunrise and sunset. You can watch the path of the sun through the sky. Eclipses of the sun are very interesting if you happen to be in the right location. It's always good to watch out for eclipses. Partial eclipses of the sun don't really make much difference. It looks still pretty bright outside. But they're very cool to see it. In fact, I saw one. When was it? Partial eclipse of the sun a couple months ago in Minnesota. It happened to happen fairly frequently. I've never personally seen a total eclipse of the sun. The moon, of course, you can watch the phases of the moon and observe its path across the sky. Eclipses of the moon are very easy to see. And so these are good things to look at, naked eye. And then five planets. The ancients, of course, knew about many planets, and they, in fact, named the days of the week after them. Saturday is named after Saturn. Sunday is named after the sun. Moon day is named after the moon, of course. But so the five planets would be Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. These are all easy targets to see. You won't get any detail, but you'll be able to tell where they are, maybe their motion in the sky, perhaps their color a little bit. These are things you can do unaided. And then, of course, the Milky Way itself, as long as the sky is really very dark. You can see the Milky Way, and that's interesting to look at. Here's some targets for looking with the naked eye, but through telescopes. Saturn, you can see its rings. Jupiter, you can see four of its moons. These are called the Galilean moons, because Galileo was the first person to notice them. They're just barely outside of the unaided eye range, but you can see them easily with even a very modest pair of binoculars or a telescope. Venus, with its phases. The sun, again, with precautions under your telescope. You can see sunspots, watch eclipses, watch transits. Anybody see the transit of Venus? Okay, a few people did. That's good. I'm glad you did, because it's not coming back for another 100 and some odd years. Okay. So Venus crosses the surface of the sun as viewed from Earth once in a while, but not very often. A telescope with the naked eye looking in the telescope is a good way to look at that. The moon, of course, you can start to see craters. It turns out craters on the moon are just barely beyond what you can see with the naked eye. So again, even a really modest pair of binoculars or telescope, you'll start to see craters. And especially near the terminator, that's the bright to dark line. So like when the moon is half illuminated and half non-illuminated, you can kind of see the best detail. If you look at the moon right now when it's full, essentially you can see the craters, but you won't get any depth because it's like bright sun everywhere. But when the rays are glancing, then you can see them better. Here's some things that we saw the other night, for those of you who happened to come out. I was looking at Mizar, and we could see that Mizar is actually a multiple star system. I did not manage to get Albireo, but that's a very good one to look at, too. You can see the Milky Way better, again, on the dark sky conditions. You can see clouds of dust, dark dust clouds and bright glass gas clouds. You can see some nebula, the Orion Nebula, for instance, like in that picture. The planetary nebula called the Ring Nebula is available in the sky right now. It's very near the Big Dipper. It's very near the Lyra and Vega, Lyra the Liar. Globular clusters, we did see the other night, M13, which is a globular cluster of Hercules. It just looks like kind of a puff of smoke, which is more than 100,000 stars all bunched together. And then, of course, you can see galaxies. The Andromeda Galaxy, for instance, the Whirlpool Galaxy are both available. And pretty good targets. You won't see lots of detail, but you'll definitely be able to see them. It turns out that Andromeda, for instance, is not that small. Okay, and so it's not too small to be seen. It's about as big as the moon, but it's fainter than the moon, and so you have to know where to look. And if you look with a telescope, you can get a reasonably good view of it. So here's some pictures. These are approximately what you could see with a small telescope, naked eye. You can see Saturn and its rings. You can see Jupiter. You might be able to see, in this case, not only can I see a moon of Jupiter, but I can see a shadow of the moon of Jupiter on the surface. That's tricky, but it can be done. Okay, this is definitely doable. Phases of Venus, these are not the greatest photographs, but these are approximately what you could see with a pretty good telescope looking through it with your eye. You can see that puff of smoke almost, that's a globular cluster down there in the far corner. A double star slightly split apart, that happens to be an actual photograph of Albireo, where the two stars are different colors. And then of course the moon itself, you can see lots of details on the moon through a small telescope, especially along the terminator. You won't quite see this, but frankly, the Milky Way, just kind of cruising around in the Milky Way is fun to do. You won't quite see this, but cruising around, this happens to be Orion again. There are these areas of Orion that will have some color, in the Orion Nebula, for instance. Betelgeuse, which is a tremendously large star. Rigel, which is a very bright star. Betelgeuse up here. These are things that are very easily available. But the small telescopes, you will see more stars than you would see naked eye, but not quite this many. This is somewhat of a time exposure. And then the Andromeda Galaxy, which is near the constellation Andromeda, is an extended object, okay? And so if you know where to look, you can actually see that naked eye. And with a telescope, you can do pretty well on Andromeda as well. So I guess my claim, just to sum it up, is that, sure, it doesn't look that way when I look up. That's true. I will concede that. But, you know, I'm okay with that, I think. I think it's still valuable to go outside. So that's what I have for you, and I guess we have a few minutes for questions, but thank you again for coming to this presentation.
Can you talk about the iridium there?
Could you turn on the lights? Okay, so there's a set of satellites, and so these are the iridium satellites. It's a communications set. It didn't quite pan out the way people thought. But these particular satellites, my understanding is that they have some very large reflective surfaces, and that as they travel, it's not that they're tumbling, but they do rotate in a predictable fashion. And so what happens is, if you know exactly when to look, you can see a very bright flash off of these satellites, and they talk about them as iridium flares. And so, but it's just a reflection. And so if you see a regular satellite, sometimes you'll see